Right, I think let's get going. Welcome everybody to our latest Employment Law 101 session. For those of you that don't know us, my name is Peter. I'm a partner with a firm called NPM Legal. We are a specialist employment law and business immigration practice based in the south of England, but we work with businesses that are all over the world and they have a common interest, which is employing people here in the UK, and that's where we come in to help. Delighted as ever to be joined by my colleague Adrienne. Morning, Adrienne.
Good morning. Morning, everybody.
For those of you that are listening to this live, sorry, no, for those of you that are listening to this on Spotify or Amazon, I need to say that everything we're talking about is as at today's date, which is the 20th of June, 2024. So if you're listening to this in 2025, you know, the law might have changed. We might not have any employment laws left by then. Who knows?
Oh, don't be silly. It's going to go the opposite way.
It
We're
is
going to
going
have
to go the opposite way.
even more employment laws.
It is going to go
Anyway.
the opposite way. Yeah. And stay tuned for updates on, you know, more on Labour's proposals, should they get elected, which is looking ever likely. Benefit of you joining live today, though, for those of you that are here live today, is of course you get the opportunity to ask us questions. So feel free to pick our brains using the Q&A function down at the bottom. Today we are talking about small-scale redundancies. So we know that a lot of organisations are still contemplating reorganisations and redundancies at the moment as we go through 2024. And we thought it was worthwhile just revisiting what the legal principles are in relation to obligations on how you actually run those types of exercises. Really, for us, it's always about avoiding any unnecessary legal risk and kind of balancing the commercial considerations. But I think in particular, there was a case from the end of last year, wasn't there, Adrienne, that just served as a kind of useful reminder, really, of what the principles are that are in play and potentially widened out the scope in terms of how we need to go about these things.
Yeah. But before we kick off with that case, I would just say that, redundancy is it's a really tricky and really technical area. There's lots of pitfalls, lots of traps to fall into, contrary actually to probably what a lot of employers might think. I mean, I think it's fair to say, isn't it, Peter, that we get quite a few people coming to us going, well, we think we can dress this up as a redundancy when they're really looking at a performance issue or possibly even a conduct issue. I think it's normally performance. And it's our advice is always to try and stick to the true reason for dismissal, only because if things go pear-shaped and you don't end up in a settlement situation and you do end up fighting a claim, then tribunals are super critical of employers who try to use redundancy as a veil for what is really another of the fair reasons for dismissal, or maybe an unfair reason for dismissal. So I think that's the first warning I wanted to give. The second one is when we're talking about small-scale redundancies, we're talking about less than 20, obviously, because that would be the collective redundancies. But another thing to think about is when you're looking at your numbers, don't just go, oh, we want to make these five people redundant, and therefore we're not into the realms of collective consultation. Remember that you have to look at the 90-day period. So the law says that if you're proposing to make 20 or more redundancies in a 90-day period, then you're into the realms of collective. And it is a look back and look forward. So it's always worth just checking within your organization how many redundancies have been made in that 90-day period looking back and what might be coming forward, coming up, looking forward, because it's you'd have to amalgamate the numbers. So for example, if you've already made 15 redundancies in the last month and then you're going to do another five, then bingo, you're into collective and it all becomes a very messy situation. So don't look at that in isolation. I just wanted to throw that one out there.
And I
But I'm
could
not going to
throw something else in there as well, given that
go
you've
on
run
then.
a sector of numbers and collective. It's also a you can get caught out by failing to include people who are leaving under settlement agreements as well. I mean, you have to look at the underlying reason why the settlement agreement was there and whether, I kind of paraphrase, but whether or not it was a genuine voluntary agreement with no consequence if the individual said no, I don't want to accept your offer, thanks very much. But generally, but for those circumstances applying, when you're counting your numbers within that 90-day period to see whether you've got to that 20 or not, you do need to look at people who have left under settlement agreements as well. So I'd mention that so nobody gets caught out.
Right. Okay. Onto what we're going to talk about today. So what we're going to do is going to focus on an approach that the EAT took in this particular case. It was the case, if anybody wants to look it up, it's DeBank Haycox versus ADP. And it basically was an opportunity for the EAT to go through the main principles in a redundancy, looking back at all the key authorities. And it really does demonstrate the traps and the pitfalls. So before we get into the details of the case, let's look at some of the main principles of fairness, because that's what we're talking about. It's fairness. Now, there is no set process under the law. There is no set way of doing it. So it is all about fairness. And the principles basically are around consultation. So obviously consultation with employees, as I'm sure you all know, is ordinarily going to be fundamental to the fairness of any dismissal. An old case called Polkey identified the requirement for employers to warn and consult on redundancies. And in fact, most people just know of Polkey as being a case that is used in a different context. But the nub of that case was all about warning and consulting with redundancies. So, but what does warning and consulting actually mean?
Yeah, well, that case of Polkey is important on that point. So what that case established was the principle that a dismissal is not going to be usually fair unless an employee has been warned and consulted with about the proposed redundancy situation. Now, that doesn't mean that the duty to warn is separate from the duty to consult. And we know that from other decisions that have come through the tribunal system, specifically at the Employment Appeal Tribunal level, where the EAT has said the two parts, so warning and consultation, are actually part of the same single process of consultation. And all of that begins with the employee being given notice that he or she is at risk of redundancy. So those two things go hand in hand, but there's more to consultation than just warning somebody about the fact of redundancy. And the reason we know that is there was another EAT case that looked at whether or not giving a warning letter to an employee, hey employee, we're warning you that you're at risk of redundancy, actually amounted to consultation. And unsurprisingly, the EAT found a little trick with that argument and said, no, just writing a letter to an employee to say, we're warning you that you're at risk, cannot amount to consultation. So it isn't enough. But I think most of you on the call today will appreciate that. That case that looked at this warning letter and whether that was sufficient to amount to consultation in turn went back and looked at a case from 1994, and it's quite a key employment law case when you're looking at redundancy, and that was a case involving the British Coal Corporation. And what the court said in that particular British Coal case from 94 was, fair consultation involves giving the body consulted a fair and proper opportunity to understand fully the matters about which it's being consulted and to express its views on those subjects, with the consultor thereafter considering those views properly and genuinely. So that case, that British Coal case, is important because it identifies what the key components of fair redundancy consultation are. And these are consultation when the proposals are still at a formative stage. Now, it's a very easy mistake for employers to make where consultation started too late, or it's at a point in time where those proposals are not still at a formative stage, meaning the individual employees don't really have a say in being able to shape those proposals. And that's the important part. So that's the first bit. Consultation must be when proposals are at this formative stage. There needs to be adequate information provided on which to respond. And I don't know about you, Adrian, but you know, I've had several calls over the last year where the questions are, well, how much information do we actually need to provide, both in terms of collective consultation and smaller scale individual redundancy consultations? Well, the law says it needs to be adequate information. Now, what's adequate? What's adequate in one situation might not be adequate in another situation. It will always be context specific, but it needs to be adequate information that enables the employee to understand what's going on and also be able to respond to that. You've got to think, consultations, this two-way process, it's an exchange of views. It's not just imparting information from one party. There needs to be adequate time in which to respond as well. And you'll know one of the differences between collective consultation and individual consultation is with collective consultation, you have a mandatory waiting period between starting a redundancy collective exercise and when the first dismissal can actually take effect. Now, commonly people will refer to that as a minimum consultation period. Technically, that's not quite correct, but that's how it's viewed. When you're talking about individual redundancy consultations like we are today, there isn't actually a minimum specified time limit. There isn't a maximum specified time limit. You can take as long as you like. You can take as little time as you like, but the process still needs to be fair. And for that to be fair, there has to be adequate time for the employees to be able to respond to what the proposals are. And then finally, but certainly also equally important as these other considerations, is conscientious consideration of the response to the consultation. Now, what this means in practical terms for you is to consult properly in small-scale redundancy exercises, you need to have an open mind still, and the employees still need to be capable of influencing the matters which form the matter of consultation. So the subject that's under consultation, the employees still need to be able to have some influence at it. And that links back to why consultation should be when those plans are at a formative stage.
And just coming in on that time point, because I think from our perspective, we're often asked, how long will it take? Are we talking 1 or 2 weeks, etc.? And it is, I suppose what I would say to that is it's very fact specific, because it depends so much on your organization. It depends whether you've got selection pools, whether it's a standalone role, and it truly is a standalone role, because there's always question marks over whether that is the case. And I think the point being is certainly when we're advising people is you've got to build in enough time to have more consultations than you think you need, because whilst you might go, right, we'll have the at-risk meeting there, then we'll have the first consultation meeting, and then we'll go away and think about what they've said, and we'll come back to the next one. There are often aspects of it which will take longer. For example, if you've got somebody who is applying for a role within the organisation, you can't bring consultation to an end until that application process has gone through. Because ultimately, the whole point of redundancy consultation, and I think this is the key point, is it's an exploration of the ways in which redundancies can be avoided. So if you have, I've acted for individuals where they're saying, they're telling me my last consultation meeting is next week, but I've applied for 3 different jobs in the organisation, and my interview isn't until after that. Well, that doesn't make sense, because the application for a new role is a way of avoiding redundancy. So those are some of the things where that open mindset really, really comes into play. And I appreciate a business does need to plan, but try and factor in that sort of flexibility and a bit of fluidity in terms of what consultations required.
What about something that we encounter quite a lot, which is this whole issue about selection criteria and scoring, the timing of all of that, and who you're speaking to when, and before the event, after the event?
Yeah, so I mean, this is where the British Coal judgment comes in, isn't it? We're talking about consultation only being meaningful if it happens at a formative stage. So I think in that sense, there's a conflict sometimes between the commercial requirements. So for example, you might have a group of 5 people all doing the same role, and you need to reduce by 2. And we will often get employers coming to us saying, well, we don't really want to unsettle all 5. We know who the 2 are because we've done like a pre-scoring exercise. And commercially, it's totally understandable why you don't want to unsettle everybody else, because ultimately you need them to be engaged. And most importantly, you probably need them to carry on doing the work while this process goes on. But the risk there is that you haven't consulted at a formative stage with those people that are potentially impacted. So applying a selection criteria in advance and then only speaking to those people who come out the bottom of that criteria is likely to be problematic. It's going to be unfair. And this is why, because you go into a consultation meeting with an employee and you say, right, we've scored you. Unfortunately, you're at the bottom and here's your scores. They then challenge their scores. It turns out something's gone wrong. It turns out that the appraisal rating was challenged, and therefore you've got the wrong appraisal rating. But you're then in a position where you've basically pinned your colours to the mast and said this person's going, and the other people are, you may have already told that they're not selected. You then have to go back and tell them that, oops, sorry, turns out actually we have to undo it. So, in that sense, what you're really requiring to do is to allow time in the consultation process for those who are impacted or potentially impacted. It's probably the better way of phrasing it, isn't it, Peter? Is potentially impacted. They are in scope, and say to them, look, this is our objective. This is what we need to achieve. We want to talk to you about the method of how we achieve it, and we're open to ideas. We're going to have to go through a selection process. This is our proposed selection criteria, and we invite your feedback on it. And at that point, you're not narrowing down those people that you probably already know are going to be selected, but you're going to them with that open mindset of hearing what they have to say in terms of that consultation.
I think the reluctance that I encounter from organizations that don't want to take that approach kind of comes down to a couple of reasons. It's this anxiety about unsettling people, unsettling the wider workforce, and whether it's an internal matter and people are worried about destabilizing good employees and, potentially losing people or the wrong type of message being sent out. But also perhaps what it looks like to competitors or industry, the outside interest in that. That's one aspect. Then the other aspect I encounter as well is when actually the business knows who it wants to go and it wants to get that outcome, it wants to get that result, and the concern about doing things black letter law correctly is that it opens up the prospect of some difficult questions, which makes it harder for the employer to justify why it's going about things in a certain way when it's looking to engineer a certain outcome. Now, I think we both get the commercial reality of some of these exercises sometimes where a desired outcome is necessary or desired, but with that entails an element of legal risk, right?
And that's where the worlds of employment tribunals and commerce clash. And we've always said that, and that's why sort of the preferred approach is always to go down the route of a settlement agreement, so that you're buying yourself out of that risk whilst protecting the commercial realities of the business. So that's obviously always an option open to you. What is more dangerous is if you're not prepared to go down the settlement agreement route, and you think you're running a fair process, and it turns out that you're not, then you're in a situation where you might come stuck unstuck when you come to the tribunal. Let me just talk a little bit about this DeBank Haycox case, because it was quite a useful run through. The EAT held that the dismissal was unfair, noting that the tribunal at first instance found that it was fair, and this was as a result of specifically the clear absence of meaningful consultation at this formative stage that we've been talking about. He was one of a team of 16 people which his employer decided to reduce. They did the application of the selection criteria, and he scored lowest. And the employer decided how many of the team should be made redundant before he was called to a consultation meeting. So the claimant argued that his employer had failed to consult properly, and the tribunal had, at first instance, hadn't bothered considering the consultation issue adequately or at all. Now, what the EAT said was that the employers have to act within the band of reasonableness, and we hear that phrase quite a lot across employment practices. They have to follow good industrial relations practice, and that key element is consultation. So what they say is a reasonable employer will engage in consultation to minimize the impact of the redundancy. And, as we said, it's to mitigate or to avoid redundancies altogether. And while at one time consultation tended to relate to methods of selection, in more recent years it's been accepted that consultation can result in a broader range of outcomes. For example, and I think we saw this quite a lot in the pandemic, people would go, listen, I don't want to lose my job, I'm prepared to go part-time, I'm prepared to take a pay cut. And it's those types of things that would form part and parcel of consultation in redundancy. So job sharing, etc., even voluntary, right? You select one person out of the team, and then somebody comes and says, actually, do you know what? I was thinking of retiring, or can I take for voluntary? And that has impact on the others who might be in scope.
Yeah,
So look,
reorganizing in a different way, right? Doesn't
exactly.
have to involve headcount reduction necessarily.
No, exactly. So, regardless of the size of the redundancy exercise, the authorities provided that where there were representatives, they should normally be consulted at the formative stages. But, you know, due to this distinction that's evolved between collective process and individual consultation, it was less clear that this would apply when a workforce was unrepresented, either by trade union or, you know, standing body of representatives. So what the EAT said is that this has really arisen as a result of the use of labels, with individual consultation having become more a discussion about the circumstances that are specific to that individual, while collective was viewed as discussions about the overall approach to the workforce, at risk of redundancy. But in any event, what the EAT said, and particularly it should be noted, the lay members, so you know, HR reps, trade union reps, they considered that this failed to recognise the reality of good industrial relations in modern employment environments.
I think, I mean, that's one of the interesting parts of this judgment for me. It's that it's almost like they're saying there's too much of a distinction between collective redundancy consultation, where you'll be going either to a recognised trade union or getting the employees who are impacted to nominate and then elect their own representatives, versus individual redundancy consultation, where the perception, the widely held belief is that when you just need to have a one-on-one meeting and just talk about almost the effect of everything rather than what the plat, you
How
know,
you've arrived there.
yeah, how it's arisen,
Yeah.
not necessarily what the underpinning business reason is, but certainly is there an alternative to actual headcount reduction. So it I kind of get where the EET are coming from. It almost feels like an individual redundancy consultation. The temptation is to accelerate too far into the process before you get to that consultation stage. And then the consultation part of it is too narrow in scope.
Yeah. Because certainly in collective, you're going to them and going, look, these are our proposals. This is the method which this is the process we're going to run. We're going to run selection. This is our criteria. Can we have your feedback? And like this, what this case says is there's no reason why you shouldn't have similar conversations of that nature on an individual basis, and that's what you should be doing. So yeah, it's looking at those. It's making sure that during your consultation process, you're keeping that mindset open, so you're looking at different ways of and listening to the employee to see if there's different ways of achieving the same objective that you've decided that you want to do. So I think one of the things, you know, that needs to be remembered is that the tribunal can't substitute its own decision. So they have to look at what a reasonable employer would do. And you know, there have been a few cases, haven't there, Peter, where a tribunal has been found by the court at the next level to have substituted its own decision. So
Yeah,
it's
it's quite a common trap, that tribunal,
yeah
and it's,
yeah
you know, it's that reasonable responses piece, and it's not the tribunal's job to say, well, if we were the decision maker, if we were
right
in this process, especially in like a misconduct dismissal scenario, this is the outcome that we would have found. That's not the test. It's whether or not the employer has done something which sits on that band of reasonable responses. So the employer
yeah
is allowed to come to a different decision from what a tribunal would do. Because the tribunal shouldn't be saying, well, we would have decided it this way, and that's why it's all unfair. So yeah,
Yeah.
it's come up quite a few times, hasn't it? You see,
Yeah.
tribunals getting slapped down by the
I think you
EAT.
see it more in conduct cases where they go, oh, we would never have fired somebody for that. And it's like, yeah, but that's not the test.
No.
Yeah. Okay. Why is this decision of greater relevance over to you?
Well, I think basically it's part of this blurring between collective redundancy consultations, where you've got 20 or more people impacted, and individual redundancy consultations as well. So, you know, as we've said, when you're looking at collective processes, what you have to do as a business is go to representative of the affected employees. And, you know, if you don't have a standing body of reps, or you don't have a recognized trade union, then you're going to be asking the employees to nominate and elect their own, because that's the obligation, to give them the chance to do that. And most will do it. When you're looking at those situations, consultation definitely has to commence when the employer's proposals are at this formative stage, and it's got to involve the trade union reps, or it's got to involve those employee representatives if there's no recognised trade union. What this decision does is really bring into focus how you look at situations involving fewer than 20 employees. Because what the EAT are highlighting is the need for what it calls general workforce consultation. So if you do happen to look at the judgment, that phrase appears quite a lot, general workforce consultation. And that means giving all employees the opportunity to influence the employer's decision at a formative stage of the process. And that's why it's a bit of a mindset change, because I think commonly that's understood to apply mainly in collective exercises rather than individual consultation exercises. And actually, what the EAT is saying is, no, you can't have such a harsh distinction on those. It says, while a tribunal might still find that a decision to dismiss was reasonable in the absence of that full consultation, the tribunal would be expected to explain why, in the particular circumstances of that exercise, an employer it had done so, it had discounted the absence of any decent consultation. The other thing that came out of that case as well are just the points on appeal. And I think appeals against decisions to make people redundant are often seen as a bit of a silver bullet, like you can cure all ills and failures with an appeal process. And that's not quite right. The EAT have said, yes, an appeal can correct a missing aspect of an individual consultation process. So in this particular case, the EAT looked at the failure to provide the employee with their scores against the selection criteria. So you can correct that on appeal by providing the scores. You can't actually on appeal repair any failure to consult at a formative stage, because that's like quite a fundamental failing. If an employer becomes aware of such a failure, it will be faced with the need to restart its redundancy process in order to address the need to consult.
Well,
Now,
that's because the horse has already bolted, isn't
yeah,
it?
and I mean,
You
in practical terms, who's actually gonna do that? Restart
know?
a whole process. It's just not gonna happen.
No.
I doubt anyway.
No. I think it's worth saying as well that, you know, we talked about the Polkey case earlier, and for those of you that aren't aware of it, and apologies for talking in lawyer speak, but Polkey was the case which basically said that, look, you can lose a case on unfair dismissal, the employment tribunal will make a finding that your process has been unfair, and then it's when it comes to working out the amount of compensation that might be awarded, that's when there is the opportunity for you as the employer to run what's called a Polkey argument. And that Polkey argument is to show that, okay, fine, there was a defective process, we should have done X, we should have done Y, let's roll that through as if we had done it correctly, and hey presto, the outcome is the same. So on the basis that the defective process would not have impacted the outcome, then you know you invite the tribunal to make no award of compensation, because that's the whole point. Compensation is there to address any losses that flow from the unfairness. If the process had been the same outcome, that employee would still have been selected and made redundant, then there won't be any losses resulting from it, and that's the Polkey argument.
Before we just wrap up some of the learnings from this case, I just want to deal with a few questions that have come in. So thanks for
Yeah,
those
good questions.
questions. So first question, I'm staggered at the number of organizations that do not share the scoring of the individual to the individual in a selection exercise. What's the worst that can happen to the employer in such a case? Do you want to start answering that while I sneak?
Yeah, no, I mean, I think absolutely. I mean, this is the whole point about the consultation and the employee needing to understand what's happening to them. If you're withholding information such as their scoring, you know, like you say, really sorry you've been selected, and they go, how? What criteria did you use, and how did I score? Then clearly that's gonna blow a hole through any case of reasonableness and fairness that you're trying to put together. So the answer to that question is simply, you're gonna go down on unfair dismissal.
Losing unfair play.
Yeah, and coming back to that Polkey point, if you haven't shared the scores, then you know you're going to find it tough to run the Polkey argument in reality, because the chances are that the tribunal might not accept that you've even scored properly in the first place. So I think the outcome of that is you share the criteria, you get the employee's input, you then score them. And I think the other practical tip on it as well is to ensure that you've got the evidence to back up why you've given that score. And this is something that's come up time and time again in redundancy processes. Bless you, Peter, for sneezing.
Thank you.
You know, so somebody's gone on a particular criteria, it might be skills and experience, and you've scored them a two. Well, how have you arrived at a two? What's the process? What's your criteria? Did you look at their CVs? Did you run an assessment? Did you say, well, here's the evidence of when they did this piece of work for me, demonstrating they've got valid skills in that area? So you've got to make sure that when you're discussing the scores, you are able to give the employee not only an idea of what the score was, but how you arrived at it.
Okay. Another question, any advice how to manage pools when there's some similarity in roles, but they're not exactly the same? So we're not, let me just deal with that really quickly, because we could do a whole other session about that. Generally, the principle is, as an employee, you've got wide discretion in terms of what you consider the pool to be. You need to be able to show that you've applied your mind to what the correct selection pool should be. So you need to evidence that you've thought about it and you've come up with a decision which isn't just completely wacky. As long as you do that, it's very, very hard for a tribunal to interfere with the approach that you've taken. So I think think about it, record that you've thought about it, record what the decision is and why. And as long as you're, you know, you've got some semblance of it being a reasonable decision, then you're probably going to be okay. As I say, it's hard for a tribunal to interfere with that decision. You've got a lot of discretion as an employer when it comes to pools.
Again, as long as you've recorded your thought process and your decision making.
Yeah, to be able to evidence it. Yeah. Elaine asks, isn't all of this possibly changing? An organisation will be able to consult individually with employees if the redundancies are at a certain number. I mean, that's the situation at the moment. You do only have to do an individual consultation process if you have fewer than 20 employees within a 90-day period being made redundant. What that means in practice is you're not having to give the employees the opportunity to elect representatives and then deal with reps or deal with a recognised trade union like you do in a collective exercise. So that hasn't changed. I think what's
I wonder if you're getting confused with TUPE, because
that's
where the change. I wonder if you're thinking of that, because at the moment you know in a TUPE situation, which is similar, you have to elect employee reps unless you're a micro business where there are 10 or fewer employees in your business. But there's going to be a change as of the 1st of July for micro businesses where there are fewer than 50 employees, in which case you don't have to elect reps. You can speak individually. So that's a particular change. I wonder whether that's what you're thinking of, because I'm not aware of any changes to the current position that Peter's just talked about.
Helpfully, you and Mark did a session on 2P, I think 2 weeks ago. So I've just put a link to in the chat to our previous recordings. And of course, you can find them on Spotify and Amazon Music if you look for Employment Law 101 as well. Couple of other questions. Do you recommend making recordings of consultation meetings or taking minutes? I mean, one or the other. Oh, I mean, maybe both. Definitely taking minutes, I think, always. Recordings, you probably need a policy on it or an approach. I don't mean like a formal written policy and a handbook, but at the outset of an exercise, just decide what your company's stance is going to be. Generally, I'm not averse to meetings being recorded because it stands as
Undisputable record.
Undisputable, that's the word I'm looking for. Indisputable evidence and a record of exactly what was discussed. There are obviously some downsides to that in terms of, have you got complete control over what a manager is going to say in a meeting? Because if they put their foot in it, it is also recorded in there for everybody to hear. But that's not a reason necessarily not to permit recordings. I'd say in my experience, most clients that we support won't permit recordings in any type of meetings.
I'm going to put my hand up here and say I'm quite a big fan of recording, because in terms of preparation and time, I mean, it takes ages to type up notes, etc., all the rest of it. And arguably, if you've got a valid note of the meeting, any cock-ups are going to be recorded in the notes anyway. So, you know, why, you know, and there's also every chance the employee is going to record it remotely if you're doing it remotely anyway. So,
yeah, what are you? You know, what are you trying to hide?
What are you trying to hide?
Tribunals, yeah, exactly. A lot of tribunals hate it if an employee's made a surreptitious recording and not told anybody they've been recorded and tries to introduce it as evidence in a claim. They sometimes go off the deep end if that happens.
Yeah.
How do you address confidential company strategic plans when consulting at a formative stage? Well, one approach is to tell your employees that they are confidential and that they're not to disclose them. I appreciate it makes it hard to police the risk, but the concept certainly of giving confidential information to employee reps and asking them to keep it confidential in collective exercises isn't controversial.
No.
It's not unusual. They're still your employees, you know, they're going to be bound by confidentiality obligations, both those that are expressly written in the employment contract and those that are just implied and just hover there anyway. You know, employees shouldn't be divulging confidential information. It's up to you to make it clear that it is confidential information. And I appreciate that's quite a black and white answer. Sometimes it is quite difficult to know where to draw the line, but you're in charge of what the rules are, and you can stipulate what's confidential and who that to whom that information can be shared. So I think
And it
that's.
also depends who you're keeping it confidential from. I mean, if you're talking about keeping it confidential within the company, I think that's more tricky, but certainly keeping it from going outside of the company is something that you're absolutely right to stress to those you're talking to.
And then we've got another question, which is, what is your advice on bumping if an employee asks for someone else to be included in the pool? I mean, there, so potentially two different concepts there. Certainly invite feedback on what the pool should look like. This is what this case is suggesting in terms of formative stage consultation. So you could go to the employees and say, this is what we're proposing the pool to be. What do you think? And the employee might say, well, I think the pool's too narrow. We should actually include some other people. And to my point earlier on that other question, you've still got quite a lot of discretion over who goes into the pool. So you've got to apply your mind to the feedback that the employee is giving you if they're asking for the pool to be wider, because that's part of meaningful consultation, which is your legal duty. So you need to think about it. And if you don't agree, explain why you don't agree. And if you do agree, change the pool. Separate to that, there's this issue of bumping, which is, for those of you that don't know, bumping is where you have a redundancy situation affecting, let's say, one individual, and they say, look, don't make me redundant, make this other person redundant instead, and I'll take their role. So you bump the other person out of their job and give it to the at-risk employee, even though the other person is not at risk of redundancy and their role still exists. There are quite a few authorities, different cases that have said that it can be unfair for an employer not to consider bumping. So certainly, I think if it's been raised by an employee, then you'll equally need to think about it and come up with an explanation about why you don't want to do it. And then if you've got any different thoughts on
Yeah, I was going to say there's no obligation on an employer to do it though, so it's unfair to consider it potentially as well. I mean, if it's an obvious consideration, but because there's no obligation on an employer to do it, as long as they can put forward what is a reasonable explanation as to why it's rejected, then you're unlikely to come unstuck. I think the point of bumping is to remember that the person who does get bumped out of their role will still have redundancy as the reason for dismissal, even though they weren't at risk in the first place. That's where that comes in.
I think it literally feels just quite unfair, doesn't it? But
But you'd normally get it. So, for example, you might get it where you've got a senior person who's been with the company a long time, has got a wealth of information and a wealth of experience in the company. Their role is at risk. And then you might have somebody who perhaps has just joined, which again does feel really rotten, but they've just joined, they haven't got the wealth of experience, and you might think, well, we really want to keep this person, and we don't have an automatic vacancy. But absolutely right, the person who's at risk could easily do the role being carried out by the new starter. So we'll bump them out. Really sorry, we're going to bump you out. You're redundant because you're the knock-on impact, if you like, and we'll give that senior person their role instead. That's an example of redundancy. But in terms of the authorities, yes, unfair perhaps to consider it, but no obligation to do it, and they are normally quite accepting of explanations put forward by employers as to why they haven't gone through with it.
Let's just before we wrap up look at the takeaways. Sorry, Elaine's got another question about bumping.
I think I just answered it.
I'll just asking for some case names on
Oh,
bumping, and
case names. Oh,
I'll
sorry.
email you Elaine later. So I'll send you some information through. What can we take from this 2023 judgment then in terms of these redundancy principles and how you apply them for small scale exercises? Well, there's a bit of uncertainty over how general workforce consultation should actually work in practice. And for reasons we've discussed, understandably, many businesses are reluctant to open up that consultation to a wider workforce because it doesn't want to unsettle people, maybe because of reputational damage, what it looks like to third parties. If you recognize a trade union or you've got a standing staff body with whom you can consult, then it's going to be a lot easier for you to comply, because even though you're not necessarily compelled to under collective consultation rules, then you could consider still going to the union to say, look, we've got this small scale redundancy exercises. We're going to do some general workforce consultation with you before we then move on to the specific individual consultation. The judgment suggests that the correct approach is to be broad in terms of who's involved in the consultation process, and that does contradict or goes against a little bit recent accepted practice. The second point is scoring and selecting behind the scenes still entails risk. We've always advised that it entails an element of risks. It goes against ACAS best practice, but even more so now because a tribunal can rightly examine and ask why an employer didn't look at wider consultation at the early stage. So this EAT judgment just opens it up for tribunals to be able to do that.
Can I just jump in finally, and just as a reminder, when we're talking about unfairness, of course, at the moment, employees still have to have 2 years' service in order to bring the claims. But if that changes, then this is going to come into sharp focus.
Yeah, Labour are saying day one rights for unfair dismissal. So from the
Yeah.
start of employment.
That's it. No more interruptions from me. Sorry.
No, that's fine. Third point then, appeals are not the silver bullet to cure all defects. Like I mentioned, an appeal cannot repair the failure to consult at the formative stage. And if you become aware of such a failure, you're going to be faced with restarting the redundancy process in order to address the need to consult or taking a more commercial option, shall we say. And then finally, Polkey arguments are still valid. So you may still contend that a process that was defective did not change the result, but that's an argument about damage limitation in a way, rather than pure liability. So just be mindful of that. We've run over slightly. Thanks to everybody for your questions today. We're back in 2 weeks' time. We're going to be looking at settlement agreements and how to use them effectively and get the most out of them. So join us 2 weeks today, same time. In the meantime, I've put the link in the chat to our most recent videos. Please do check out our podcast on Spotify and Amazon Music. But for now, enjoy the sunshine, enjoy the rest of the week, and we'll see you in 2 weeks' time. Thanks very much.
Bye, everyone.